I don't want anything to do with this.
Good morning, everybody. I'd like to call the meeting to order. We're going to move rather quickly today. We had an hour and a half agenda that was changed this morning to an hour's worth of time because of another meeting that's obviously more exciting and more important. So the first thing I'd like to do is go ahead and
Organizational meeting.
So we're going to open an organizational meeting to adopt our great rule list for the task force. So with that, I would take, has everybody had a chance to read the rules?
They're all great.
Sounds like we got a positive response there. So with that, I'd entertain a motion.
Chair Freeman, I move to adopt the proposed task force rules.
Great. So Chair Barton has made a motion to adopt the proposed task force rules. Is there any discussion?
None.
Is there anybody object? Wow, we got through that. So that motion passes. So we now have a set of rules to work by. So with that, I think we'll move right into the informational meeting portion of the agenda. And I think we'll invite up some of the folks from Grow Oregon, the Economic Gardening Program, Michael Lanoff. Mm-hmm. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Great. Good morning, co-chairs, members of the task force. Michael Lanoff, State Director, Oregon Small Business Development Center Network. Appreciate the opportunity to meet with you this morning and to reflect on the first round, the pilot, in the last biennium of the Grow Oregon program. And I'm going to start with a pop quiz. I'm an academician. Started my community college career at Southwestern Oregon Community College in 1987. So here's a quick pop quiz, but there's a clue. This picture was taken shortly before the Maytag repairman was laid off by Maytag and started his own business. So who hires more Oregonians? Oregon's best businesses are small businesses. And one of basically want to lay the groundwork for the rationale behind the Grow Oregon program to provide target assistance to Stage 2 companies. So here we are, the 500-plus employees, firms employ 11% of the Oregonians. 0 to 99, that's 66%, but the sweet spot really are the Stage 2 companies, the 10 to 99 employee firms, who during this particular period employ 47% of everyone in the private sector workforce in our state. And we also showed a 2% increase between 2011 and 2012. So the basic premise then was to look at companies that were Stage 2, that were poised for growth, and provide resources to help them grow even more to create new jobs for Oregonians. So our value proposition, again, was to look at targeted and strategic assistance for these companies. Starts with the front end with a very comprehensive assessment of these companies' growth needs. And then you can see the list of other services we provided along the way. Now, these eligibility criteria, in addition to the size of 10 to 99 employees, the eligible companies must be Oregon-based traded sector companies, must have at least $1 million in annual revenue, and also needed to prove to us demonstrated growth in three of the last 5 years. So keep in mind, we started enrolling companies in March of 2012. So that previous five years were some tough times for Oregon small businesses. So we had, in fact, some companies that demonstrated fairly good growth in 2008, maybe had a slump in 2009, but then rebounded and were on a growth trajectory again at the time we contacted them and brought them in to the Grow Oregon program. So the pilot then we had at the completion 37 enrolled companies, and they were statewide, 9 in the Portland metro area, and you can see the other distribution. And we were basically all the way from Pendleton to Astoria in our recruitment, and then all the way down to Central Point was, I think, our furthest south. that we had engaged companies. The impacts to date, and again, we're going to be tracking these companies through the end of 2015, because I think the assistance we're providing, which is really advanced market research and then counseling those businesses to develop marketing strategies based on the research, it could take up to 2 years to fully execute those strategies. So we're going to keep tracking them, but to date, or at least when I compiled these data, we were at 48 FTEs and 4 part-time jobs among these 37 companies. The companies also reported over $2 million in debt and equity financing that they attributed as a direct result to the assistance they received through the Grow Oregon program, and also a $4.6 million sales increase. And then the total state investment in this program was $300,000. Here's my NASCAR slide for you today. These are a sampling of some of those 37 companies. And some of these names I would think would be very familiar to members of the task force. And I'm going to spare you the other 36 slides I brought to the meeting today. I do have another here. So we are taking a run and start at the 2013-15 program. The legislative appropriation, I think there was a slight rescission by the LFO because it is a lottery-funded project. So basically $245,000 was appropriated. We're going to target approximately 25 companies statewide. There's my last slide, and I would certainly entertain questions from chairs or task force members.
Thank you, and I guess maybe I'll start with a quick comment. I'd like to thank you for the work that you're doing, and especially the fact that you are focusing on the entire state.
Absolutely.
Oftentimes, some of the larger economic development programs focus solely up here in the valley and up north, which I know is good for their areas, but to see that you are working around the states is very encouraging, and that seems like an incredible return on investment, so very nice job.
Thank you.
Other comments or questions?
I have a question.
Thank
you. Call me Barnhart. That was fighting words, Co-Chair Freeman. In terms of, we had a pilot there in 2009. You have some funding going forward. What do we need to take this to the next level, if anything? Is this kind of, what are our next steps? Do you just need more money? Is there anything else? Where do we go from here?
Co-chairs, Representative Barton, we're almost in a phase two pilot here, and I think we're going to with targeting the 25 companies, and we're also leveraging the other resources of the Oregon Small Business Development Center network, which the legislature has also invested in. That was a separate appropriation. So I would advise the legislature just to watch this program carefully, because again, we'll be tracking the results of that first cohort. We're not going to let go of those businesses, and then we'll see if we can adjust our service delivery model a little bit, and also try to do what we can to leverage other funds. I guess the best problem to have would be for us to enroll 25 businesses in the next 6 to 10 months,
mm-hmm.
and then have an increasing demand for the program. So didn't mean to obfuscate there, but I think we just stay the course for now and see how we do with this next cohort.
Thank you.
Anything further there, Chair Barton? If not, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Thank you. I think maybe I misheard you, but I thought I heard you say that you contact companies to enroll them. Did I hear that correctly?
It's co-chairs, Representative Thatcher. It is somewhat of a push marketing approach. We work very closely with chambers of commerce, with the various economic entities. I provided the task force with the report I submitted to Business Oregon. It's an easy read, 5.5 pages, 12-point font, and it lists really how we did approach. We located initially our three service centers in Grants Pass, Bend, and Portland. So we worked very closely with SoReady down in Southern Oregon, and with EDCO in Central Oregon, and with the various economic entities in the Portland metro area. So we had excellent referrals. Also, because we were contracted with Business Oregon, the business development development officers were also sources of referrals. So we, it wasn't really cold calling by any means, ma'am. It was very much working on warm leads and trying to profile businesses from the beginning to make sure they met those eligibility criteria so we didn't have false expectations on the part of a potential enrolled client.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And as you know, I'm a big fan of SBDCs. I know how I would answer this question, but I'd like to hear how you would answer the question. As you're meeting all these startups and you're talking to people that are trying to get something going, what are the three most common concerns or challenges you're hearing from these folks that stand between them and success?
Co-Chairs, Representative Gomberg, oftentimes it's access to capital, particularly with a pre-venture client. Secondly, it's just a proof of concept. You know, there's some risk involved, as you know very well, Representative Gomberg, and being an entrepreneur. So to help them mitigate risk, I guess. And thirdly, location, and make sure that they're well located and that they're having the right product with the right audience. So those three jump to mind fairly quickly.
Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you very much for being here. Excellent job you're doing. Please keep up the good work, and we'll look forward to future reports and success stories.
My pleasure, Co-Chair, and be very glad to give you an update at any time. Work with Ms. Nordland and
Perfect.
See when that's convenient for everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So with that, we'll move on to the next agenda item, and we'll have the folks come up from the Employment Insurance Department and talk a little bit about Self-Employment Assistance Program. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Co-Chairs, members of the task force. And this will actually tie in well with the presentation that you just heard. For the record, David Gerstenfeld, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Employment Department, and here to talk about our Self-Employment Assistance Program. Assuming I can handle the technology, but so far. So the Self-Employment Assistance Program comes at self-employment from a particular perspective. It's not fundamentally an economic development program to start. It's looking at how to help people who are unemployed find a way back into being gainfully employed. What it does is it allows people who would otherwise be eligible for unemployment insurance to, instead of looking to find a job, to actually receive benefits while they're starting up their own business. This can be very helpful, especially during the recession. We saw a huge increase in interest in this in Oregon and nationally. When there are just so many more people looking for work than there are jobs, this is another outlet for people to try to create a job for themselves and potentially for others. I'll give you some history and some current context. This started out as kind of a pilot project as part of the NAFTA legislation at the federal level. Senators Ted Kennedy and Ron Wyden co-sponsored the portion of the bill that dealt with the Self-Employment Assistance Program. So from the beginning, Oregon has been very involved. We started out with four participants in 1995. It's still a relatively small program compared to the total number of people in the state and the number of people getting benefits. It's grown significantly from four a year, though. It became permanent in 1999. We've had about 5,000 people total in the program. And we're one of a handful of states that has had this going pretty much continuously. And as I said, during the recession, a lot of other states became more interested. The Federal Department of Labor is much more interested. And we work pretty closely with them. I know I've spoken to my colleagues in several other states talking about how the program works in Oregon and some of the successes. And some of you may have seen media articles about some of the higher profile successes. So the starting point is kind of who can participate and how the program works. The people that can participate, as I said, are people that would normally be getting unemployment insurance. Because it wasn't designed to be an economic development program, but it was trying to get there in the intent, it requires that there be no impact on the trust fund that is used to pay unemployment benefits. So what we do is we look for people who are likely to use up their 26 weeks of regular benefits and still not have a job. And those people are eligible for this program. During the recession, that was a much larger percentage of the people that were claiming benefits. One of the conceptual challenges that this creates, though, is that the people that are most likely to run out of benefits and still not be employed are not, that's not the same as screening for people who have the best chance of success in being an entrepreneur. So that initial gate to be eligible to participate isn't really looking at how likely they are to succeed. It's just whether they're likely to run out of benefits. What they get is normally to receive benefits, you have to be actively looking for a job. And if you get offered a job, you have to accept it. And if you start earning money, that can reduce or completely eliminate the amount of weekly unemployment benefits that you get. When you're in this program, you're not looking for a job. You don't have to accept work that's offered. And your earnings don't reduce or eliminate your benefit eligibility. Instead, what you do is you spend your time, instead of looking for a job or working for someone else, you spend your time full-time promoting your business or getting entrepreneur training and guidance. So to apply for the program, we try to notify people as early in the process as possible. That's one of the things that we've seen does relate to success. It's a maximum of 26 weeks, which is not a long time to get a new business started. So the earlier in the process we can get people headed down this direction, the better for them. So they submit an application to us with some very high-level basic information about their business. Some people come in with a much more sophisticated, detailed business plan. Sometimes it's much less sophisticated, very high-level. When the program first started out, we throughout have had a partnership with the SBDCs with this program. And initially, the SBDCs actually reviewed those initial submissions to look at them to see how likely the people were to succeed with their business venture. As they had declining revenues and increasing demands on their time, that became increasingly difficult. The Employment Department worked with the SBDCs and developed a tool to look at the application and, using some relatively objective criteria, rate the plan that we get to see if we think that it is likely to succeed. So that tool was one that was jointly developed, that the Employment Department is the primary user of that tool now when we get these plans. If it looks like it passes that kind of feasibility review, we give people written notification that they're in the program and obviously a lot more information about what they need to do and can do and some resources. If someone is not accepted into the program, we give them a written notice and tell them why. If it's because their plan didn't meet the feasibility requirements, sometimes they contact us and give us additional information, and we're able to reevaluate. In any event, they have the right to challenge that decision through a hearing process. We have a pretty high success rate of people that apply getting accepted, though. It's varied over the years, and it's generally ranged from about 80 to 95%. So it is a pretty flexible program. It has to be a business that can be legally operated in Oregon. The owner has to be able to legally operate the business. They have to be working full-time on their business. So that's either directly their business, or if they're receiving entrepreneurship training, that counts. And then within 30 days of being accepted into the program, we do require them to submit a formal business plan and to register their business with the Internal Revenue Service and the Secretary of State. So I want to talk a little bit about outcomes, and I'll give a little bit of a warning that one of the challenges the program has is it's not as easy as we would like to get comprehensive long-term data. So we did a survey in 2010, 2011, and we received about 22% response rate. We do think that the people that had success stories were probably much more likely to want to talk to us about them than people that had businesses that didn't succeed. But even looking at this as just 22%, there's still some notable successes here. So when we looked at this, we had 373 of those people that we asked responded. 261 of them at that point had launched their business. And that chart just sets out the stage. The 1% is kind of the aberration. That was someone that had not only started up their business but got it far enough along that they had then sold their business to someone. A number of them were in the startup or the emerging stage, and then the blue part there of 12% were those that were no longer operating, that they weren't viable at that point. And while 12% is, that's still a significant number of businesses in terms of people starting up their own business, especially during the time period we're talking about, we actually feel that that's a pretty high success rate for the businesses. The other thing that we asked about was how many people these businesses that did start up employed. We did so, and we have some numbers here. So you can see 53 of them reported having at least one full-time employee, and then some others that had part-time or intermittent employees. These do not include temporary employees. And we believe that a lot of these startup businesses, until they get more established, probably rely more heavily on employee leasing companies, temporary agencies, and things like that. We do have some failures. Not every entrepreneur succeeds. It doesn't take that many successes, though, to be a significant net gain for the state and for the program. So we asked the people that responded to the survey to provide information about their estimated payroll. We've also, in some cases, been able to look at our tax filings to get information, which is pretty consistent with this. So 17 of those businesses had payroll of over $100,000 annual payroll. So that represents significant addition to the workforce. The largest one, we had one business that reported $1.4 million in annual payroll. So some of these people don't succeed at the end of the program. Their business isn't there. In the big picture, these are the people that were likely to run out of unemployment benefits and still not be employed. So they didn't succeed going this route either, which is something that we need to deal with. But from the large picture, a couple of these big successes adds to the overall workforce, which is very helpful. We receive a lot of positive feedback about the program from the participants. The biggest challenges that they voice are getting more technical assistance about how to start a business. The Employment Department, we provide some assistance, but frankly, that we're not experts in that area. And that's something that we rely on the SBDCs and other businesses. The other suggestion is that they would like more weeks of coverage, pointing out that 26 weeks is not a real long time to go from I have an idea to I have a sustainable, viable business. Here are some other statistics. The one I'll focus on the most is that middle one. These are businesses that were started between 2004 and 2009, and when we surveyed them in 2011, 77% of those businesses were still active. And given just the general rate of failure for new businesses, we think that that's a very good success rate. There have been some recent changes to the program. There was federal legislation that did allow some people to get this benefit while they're on federal extensions. Before that federal legislation, you could only get it while you were on regular benefits. So during the recession, we might have people that try to, you know, I lost my job, I've been looking for a job, and maybe it's 25 weeks before I realize that this recession is really bad. My job isn't available in my area anymore. I want to start my own business. They weren't able to take advantage of this program. With this federal legislation, they are able to do that. And in 2013, Senate Bill 192 passed, which made some required corresponding changes to state law. That federal law also provided a grant opportunity, and I'm happy to report that earlier this morning, the Ways and Means Committee approved the retroactive approval that the Employment Department made to the Department of Labor. We have been notified that we received that grant, so about $332,000. And this is really going to be focused on two things. One is outreach to people that could benefit from the program. That early notification and participation is key. There's a federal cap on how many people can participate. You can't have more than 5% of the people that are claiming benefits in this program. Oregon has one of the strongest programs nationally, and we still have never really approached that cap. So we think there's opportunity there to bring more people that could be successful into the program. Even more important is it lets us work with SBDCs and microenterprise counselors and other groups to actually give substantive technical assistance to people as they start up their business. We think that that's something that could really be of benefit to the people participating in the program as a whole. So this is some funding where we'll be working with the SBDCs and others to make sure that that technical assistance is available. It included some technology to help us provide that in the more remote areas of the state as well, so that we're not saying, we have this great session for you to come to. Please drive from Burns to Portland to get the two-hour session. So we're excited about the grant, and we're starting to work now with the SBDCs and others to implement that. So that's kind of an overview of the program, and I'd be happy to take any comments or questions that you may have.
Okay. Sounds like a great program. Yeah. Do we have questions amongst the task force members?
I'm good.
We'll start. Oh,
Fletcher.
Just going back to your slide with the pie chart on it, and it showed the results from 373 SEA participants. I was just curious, what period of time does that cover?
The survey was done in 2010, 2011, and I believe it covered about 4 or 5 years of prior participants.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Great program. You mentioned that one of the requirements for application is the business plan.
Yes.
And just give me a quick sense of how detailed that plan needs to be. There are plans and there are plans.
Co-Chairs, Representative Gomberg, you're absolutely correct. As I said, some of them that we get are very professional-looking business plans, people that are pretty sophisticated and know what they're doing. Other people are not as sophisticated, and we get... sometimes in format and presentation, it's rather rough, and sometimes in content. What we're looking at is an acknowledgement of some of the core issues they're going to have to face and some reflected way to deal with it. So, for instance, some understanding of what some of the registration or licensing requirements might be, if there are. Some plan about capital. If someone says, I want to start a manufacturing plant, and they don't reflect an understanding that you need some upfront capital to get the equipment or some way to do that, we think that that is probably not a good sign of success for that venture. So we're not too picky about the format. We want to see those kind of core issues being addressed to some extent. And then within the 30 days, we expect a more detailed, more formal kind of traditional business plan.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, a quick follow-up?
Oh, certainly. You
also explained to us that if an application is denied, that somebody can appeal that through the administrative hearings process. Do their unemployment benefits continue during the appeal process? How does that work?
If they are, I'll give you a technical answer and then how it plays out. The technical answer is that if they're already receiving benefits, they would probably continue to receive those. Typically, we've denied them, so they wouldn't be. One of the challenges with this program, as I mentioned earlier, is although some people can be trying to start their own business and still be available to work 40 hours a week and actually be looking for a job, many people can't. It's essentially having two full-time jobs, and many people can't do that. If someone is honestly spending their time trying to start their own business and for whatever reason they don't qualify for this program, if they're not actively looking for a job and available to accept other work, then they wouldn't qualify for regular unemployment benefits.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having two full-time jobs, I just...
Seems normal, right?
Yeah.
Great. Well, again, with no other questions, thank you for the presentation. And we'll move on to the next agenda item. And I appreciate you continuing to be with us today and taking a few minutes to talk about this process and issue. And I know we had a chance to talk about this earlier in the week in my office, and I want to thank you again for taking the time to come and visit a little bit, and I know you're starting to get some responses from some of those that I've asked to respond, and I'll go ahead and apologize. The first one you got will be the nicest one. So, with that, please.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the task force. Again, for the record, David Gerstenfeld with the Employment Department, and thank you for having me here, and I appreciated that discussion, Representative Freeman. And the feedback. We like everyone to be happy with everything that we do. We don't think we'll probably ever achieve that, but we certainly want to know when people are dissatisfied so we can improve. So what I wanted to talk about was just in general the claims resolution process. With the unemployment insurance program, that is a key part of what we do, is deciding whether people get benefits. I attempted to simplify the entire unemployment insurance program into one slide. So this is the overview. We have employers, starts with them having their employees. They put money into the unemployment insurance trust fund. When those employees become unemployed and meet the eligibility requirements, they receive benefits that are paid out of that trust fund. The money then goes to those individuals or families in the communities to help support the communities, especially, for instance, during the recession. In 2012, there was about $1.5 billion in benefits paid through these programs in Oregon, which helps a lot support the communities and stop the impact on businesses from being even worse. I want to talk a little bit about the arrow going from employers to the trust fund. Most employers in the state, that's done through a payroll tax, and it's a tax that's based on two factors. One is how healthy that trust fund is. And Oregon has a very healthy trust fund. We currently have the second highest balance nationally. I think there are still about 18 states that owe collectively several billions of dollars. Oregon and just a handful of states were able to stay solvent throughout the recession, which is a credit to the kind of statutory formulas that are in place that didn't require trying to change that system in the midst of an economic crisis. Their tax rate also depends on their claims history. So kind of like any other insurance type of policy, the more claims that you tend to have, the higher your rates tend to be. There are some employers that are reimbursing. Some governments, some nonprofits can be reimbursing. What that means is instead of paying a tax, they actually reimburse the trust fund dollar for dollar for benefits that are paid out. And as we discussed, Representative Freeman, we certainly understand that, especially for some of the smaller nonprofits, but even larger ones, that can have a real significant impact if a single claim is filed and benefits are paid out for a long period of time. So that's the system as a whole, and the key is trying to make sure that we do what state law says and what we're required to do under federal requirements. We receive federal funding for the administration of the program, and Oregon employers receive a credit against their federal tax obligation as long as in Oregon our unemployment system stays consistent with certain federal requirements. Some of those are procedural. So the hearing opportunity that I mentioned that I'll be talking about some more, that's required under federal law. There's also some substantive requirements that the Department of Labor has that we have to be consistent with. The consequences of not being consistent are pretty drastic. Our last estimates, it's about $109 million of administrative funding for the Employment Department. More importantly, it was estimated to be about $1 billion over the 13-15 biennium of increased payroll taxes for employers if the Department of Labor were to say that our program was not consistent with the federal program. So we take seriously our obligation to coordinate with the Department of Labor and make sure we're consistent. So I want to talk about the claims process from a few different perspectives. From the claimant perspective, and this is very high level, skipping a lot of the detailed steps, someone files a claim for benefits with us. Oregon requires a waiting week where you meet all of the eligibility requirements, but you do not receive a payment. After that, if they claim and they meet all of the eligibility requirements, we would go ahead and process their payment and issue them a payment. So from the claimant perspective, that's the nice, simple scenario. From the employer perspective, the day after we process that claim, we notify the employer that a claim has been filed, and we ask for some information. At each point in this process, we're dependent on the information that we have. So if someone files a claim and says, I was laid off for lack of work, sometimes the employer agrees that that's what happened. Sometimes they have a very different story as to what took place. Until we get the information from the employer, we only have the information that's in front of us to work with. So by statute, employers in Oregon have 10 days to respond, which is a short time period. But again, the purpose behind that is to make sure that we're getting this information early in the process. So you can see these two timelines mesh together real smoothly when there's no issues. We get a claim, we tell the employer, we get information back, we process the payment, and everything goes smoothly. Everything doesn't always go smoothly. Sometimes we identify issues that mean someone might not be eligible for benefits. We can identify those issues. Sometimes a claimant will tell us, well, they fired me. They said that I was absent too much. We would identify that as before we make any payments, we need to investigate that and talk to the employer. If what the claimant tells us doesn't raise any issues, then unless we get information from another source, usually the employer that raises an issue, we proceed and we pay the benefits. Frequently, we do get information from the employer. The employer says they weren't laid off. We did fire them because they missed too much work. We say, great, we have an issue. We need to investigate that. We have staff investigate it. We try to resolve those within 21 days of when we first identify the issue, which is a pretty tight timeline. A lot of these tight timelines relate to federal requirements that we promptly pay benefits to people when they're due. And that we give due process to people if we're stopping their eligibility. Once we've made a payment or told someone that they're eligible, we're required, as a matter of due process in federal law, if we're going to change that decision, to give them formal notice and a chance to respond. So that's why we try to focus on getting the information early. There are several appeal processes then that can be pursued if people disagree with them, and I'll talk about those briefly. I'll talk about the investigation just a little bit. That's typically one of our adjudicators, and they will talk by telephone or by sending a letter. They will request information. This is not a situation where everyone is in the room together. So the adjudicator talks to the claimant and gets their side of the story, talks to the employer, gets their information, and if necessary, does some follow-up back and forth. As I mentioned, there's the 21-day timeline, so that they do that investigation, they issue a decision that says, yes, the person gets benefits, or no, it doesn't, and explains that either side then has 20 days to request a hearing if they disagree. If a hearing is requested, it goes to the Office of Administrative Hearings, where they have administrative law judges. They start over looking at the situation. Frequently, the information that they get at the hearing is different from what the adjudicator received. That can be either because, as the employer, I get the decision and see that, wow, the adjudicator didn't understand what I was saying, or they pointed out that I didn't give them a piece of information. I'm going to make sure to present that. Sometimes there are other people that participate in the hearing. A lot of it is also because you have at least the opportunity for everyone to be their telephone hearings, but virtually in the room at the same time. So if the claimant says something that the employer disagrees with, they hear it on the spot and they have a chance to follow up and ask questions and help point out why that's not the case. So the administrative law judge does that process and they issue a written decision. They're not bound by that initial decision that was made. Either side again has the opportunity to appeal that to the Employment Appeals Board. The Employment Appeals Board doesn't start over with taking new evidence. They just look at what took place during the hearing. They're not bound by the decisions that have been made, though. So they can look at the evidence and decide that the facts are completely different or change the decision. The appeal from that point on goes to the Court of Appeals, which is a much more formal process. It's a pretty small number of cases annually that go up to that level of formality. Once it's at the Court of Appeals, it's much less likely that they're going to change the facts of the case, and they give more deference to decisions that have already been made. So for everyone who's involved with the process, the earlier information comes out, the better. And the less onerous the process is, the earlier in the process we are. So we're doing a couple of things to really focus on trying to improve the process. And part of this is making sure people understand how vital it is that we get the information early. And this kind of ties into the next bullet point, which is we understand that employers do not start their business with the desire to exist to respond to Employment Department requests. So we're trying to make it easier for them to respond to us quickly. It is important that we get the information quickly, because if we've already started to make payments before we receive the information from the employer, we may end up with overpayments. And that's something that we're working very vigorously on reducing the overpayments, and a key part of that is getting the information early. Another part of our communication improvement is, as we discussed, Representative Freeman, I think employers sometimes get the impression that we are second-guessing their hiring and firing decisions, where we're telling someone, this person gets benefits, you shouldn't have fired them. And that's not our role, but we need to explain what our role is better so that businesses understand that. We're determining benefit eligibility, and frequently we may agree that someone was fired for absolutely legitimate business reasons, but they meet the standard to be eligible for benefits. The most common example is if someone is missing a lot of work because of a serious medical condition. It's very understandable that a business would have to get someone that could be at work to do the job, but that would not make the person ineligible for unemployment benefits necessarily. So that's something that we recognize we need to work on, so that we're clarifying that. And it also helps the employers know what information to give us that will impact the decision. One of the key things we're doing is working on some tools to improve the communication process. I mentioned that we send a notice to businesses when a claim is filed. Historically, that's been a paper form that we mail out. For large businesses, that poses problems of it getting to the right desk for the business to be able to respond to. For small businesses, it poses problems of the one- or two-person business, and I was doing something else. and there aren't the same opportunities to have backup coverage for things. So what we've done is we've implemented two related tools. SIDES is one that is geared towards large employers, and I'll just touch briefly on it since this is the Small Business Task Force. But it's a pretty sophisticated electronic system. It's a national system where the notice of the claim being filed gets sent to the employer electronically. They can respond electronically. They can track the responses. This has had a really big success rate with us getting information more quickly. The last time I pulled the numbers, we had had something like 17,000 responses that had been filed through this, and all but one of them had been filed within the 10-day time period, which is a huge improvement over prior performance. So that really helps us deal with the overpayments, and we think reflects that it is more convenient for the employers. We have another system that we call eResponse, which is designed specifically for small employers. The employer currently still gets the paper notification of the claim, but instead of filling out the paper form asking why the person doesn't work there anymore, there's a link that they can go to. They enter a PIN, and they can answer the questions online. So it has a couple of benefits for the small business. There's some just paper postage savings. You can track it. So periodically, with the volume of work, things do get lost in the mail. It's no small business wants to be having the conversation of, I know I sent it to you, and us saying, we didn't receive it. This actually has a tracking mechanism in it so that they can confirm that it was filed. They can give us a tracking number if a concern ever comes up. It also lets them amend it electronically. We're starting a project to make available that notice that a claim was filed via email, and it will take some work for us to tie this into our other legacy systems. But the intent is that small businesses that would prefer to get the notice electronically would be able to do that. That will offer a lot of benefits. You get the notice a couple days quicker. If you have multiple locations or maybe not a fixed business location, as long as you or a designee has access to the email, they'll get the notice. So it's a lot easier to stay on top of, and we think that that'll significantly improve that back and forth with employers, especially the smaller employers. So those are some of the issues that we're working on as it relates to the claims process. And, again, happy to answer any questions now, or if any other members of the task force have questions for offline, we're certainly happy to follow up and hear feedback.
Great. Thank you for the presentation. And I am painfully aware of the complication, having operated the business now for a little over 22 years. The idea of the electronic type of response and a notification just for time savings to get it right makes a lot of sense to me, and thank you for working on that. But one thing I would like to point out is sort of one of those situations where if a employee or a claimant in your chart makes a mistake or an error, or if the agency makes a mistake or error, or the business makes a mistake or error, all those mistakes are paid for by the employers, because it all comes out of the trust fund. So it's really important that we make sure that everybody's doing their very best to get it right to begin with, because when we're paying benefits that are not earned, it does cost employers in Oregon into the future more money. That being said, it's very important those that have earned benefits and deserve to get paid are paid accordingly. So I understand that balance. And quite clearly, with some of the folks that responded to a recent questionnaire that I sent out have some concerns about the process. So I appreciate you being willing to look at those and look for solutions. Other comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too appreciate the efforts that are being taken to communicate more effectively with smaller businesses in the initial stages, but I'm concerned about the administrative hearing process. And if you'll indulge me with a very brief story, we had an occasion to request a hearing several years ago and applied for hearing, and on the application it says, when are you not available? And we said, we're going to be out of the country until the 10th. And we came home on the evening of the 10th, went to the post office that opened at 9 o'clock in the morning, and received notice that the hearing was scheduled for that morning, the 11th, at 8:30 a.m. We had defaulted. We appealed that default and were notified that the decision was that even though we were out of the country and unavailable and had told you that, we were responsible for checking our mail. That was the decision that we were issued. And so my question is, how do we make this process more user-friendly for the smallest of businesses that don't have larger staffs and infrastructure to be checking these details? Can we use the same email process for the administrative hearing process that we do for initial notifications?
Co-chairs, Representative Gomberg, I don't think we can use the same system, and the reason for that, this is part of the national system that Oregon, we opted to participate in. It's geared towards just that initial part of the claims process. The appeals process is very widely across the country, and at least as of now, this system doesn't really work. To add the appeals function in for that electronic notification, I do know that the Office of Administrative Hearings is aware of those types of issues, and I know is interested in communicating better. I don't think this is a tool that would work for that. I do think there was some legislative action a session or two ago to broaden the good cause definition that allows people to kind of reopen a hearing if they do miss it for some reason. That's kind of an after-the-fact fix, and we do prefer to get the communication up front. But from a more holistic perspective, we're working to try to redo a lot of our communications so that they're more understandable. That's not always easy when we're trying to explain the federal extension requirements and how the whole system works in English to people that don't particularly want to study federal unemployment insurance and state unemployment insurance laws. But we think that we can do better than we have, and we're working on that. We think that that will help a lot, even if it's just earlier in the process, letting employers know and the claimants, if you get to the hearing stage, here's what to expect. And we might be able to head off some of those challenges by doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My point simply being that we need to continue to focus on how to make this process a lot easier for the smallest of businesses in Oregon.
And thank you for that comment. I cannot agree with you more. Have good to tell stories about calls that I've been a part of, and I'll tell you a quick story about a business that's in my district that had an employee leave because their husband was transferred. Of course, that benefit was acceptable and given, and the employer repeatedly, you'll get to hear this report, repeatedly explained to the department that, in fact, the husband had been transferred, but he was transferred from the Douglas County Jail to the Lane County Jail. And I don't believe that is a covered benefit for leaving employment. But it's those type of communication, and I don't believe the person said anything wrong or lied when they said that their husband was transferred, because in fact he was, but the assumption was that he'd been transferred for employment, and certainly not because he had been transferred from one jail to another. So it's those types of communication errors or lack of communication that really does seem to frustrate businesses around the state of Oregon. So appreciate your willingness to take that on. Representative Thatcher?
Thank you. Now, this kind of ties into previous conversations I have heard in previous committees, like during the regular session. You are stating that, Oregon employers pay taxes into the Oregon Unemployment Compensation Trust Fund. And then it goes back to the definition of employer, because we just heard from Mr. Lanoff about how people will start up their own businesses. And I should have asked the question while I was up here, asking whether people, starting their own, selling Medifast thing was part of starting up your own business, or purchasing a franchise, McDonald's franchise, whatever. But it's my understanding from these previous committees that the franchisor, like McDonald's, would be considered the employer, and Medifast, on this multi-level marketing thing, would be considered, as an employer subject to unemployment tax. Is that still the interpretation? When did that start?
Co-chairs, Representative Thatcher, that the way that employer is defined for the Employment Department and Department of Revenue and some other agencies, it doesn't split it out. It has a statutory test with a number of factors. It doesn't say if you're a franchisor, you are an employer, or you're not an employer. It has a list of criteria in it. Most of the franchise situations that we see, the franchisor is considered an employer. I'll get the franchisee and franchisor wrong, too. In most situations, the franchisor McDonald's Corporation, as an example, would not be considered the employer of someone who operates a local McDonald's franchise operation. There can be situations where they would fit that definition of an employer, despite there being a franchise relationship. We've seen that in a very small percentage of the franchise arrangements that we've ever looked at. And also with the direct sales, again, there is a statutory exemption for some types of direct sales. It gets rather detailed. I'd be happy to follow up with some specifics offline. I just hesitate to do it off the top of my head without having the statutes here with what those criteria are.
Okay. Thank you. Because there was concern from some people because maybe they weren't successful selling whatever it was, and then they want to list that as their employer, and then suddenly they were being targeted, they being the bigger entity being focused on as, well, you were subject to paying these unemployment taxes, but maybe I have that mixed up.
Co-chairs, Representative Thatcher, we do have those scenarios quite frequently, and it can play out a number of ways. It could be someone who actually is not an employee, but when they have no income because their venture is not successful, they're looking for income, they file a claim for benefits. Mm-hmm. We have to examine the situation. Mm-hmm. Frequently we look at it and say no. Sometimes we look at it and say yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really a distinction based on was there a franchise relationship, was it direct sales. It's a multi-factor test that we apply.
Well, I was just curious how we defined employer, that's all.
Well, I appreciate the question as a Shell dealer. I realize that Shell has nothing to do with my employment tax or employees, so, but I could be complicated in other areas, so thank you. Anything else from the task force? Again, thank you for your willingness to visit with us a little bit about this. I look forward to being part of the solution. So if there's a opportunity for myself or anybody involved in this committee to help you find a way to better communicate and solve some of those issues, it's an offer that stands.
Well, thank you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Barton, have you have anything else for the good of the order for the committee?
No, I appreciate everyone's flexibility. It's been a busy week. And so I appreciate the flexibility in setting the agenda and changing it the morning of.
The rumor is there's some kind of deal at foot that people are talking about, so I'm sure there's going to be some more discussion about that and some flexibility in the coming days. So,
yes, indeed.
Anybody else have anything?
Thank you.
With that, I will go ahead and close the task force. Thank you all for being here. Thank you all for being here. With that, I will go ahead and close the task force.